All right, let's dive into this. Morality, huh? We're taking a look at a chapter called The Nature of Morality. Looks like it's from some kind of ethics textbook.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, should be fascinating. So our goal here is to really break down, like, what makes something moral, you know? Where do our ideas of right and wrong even come from? And the big question, does any of it actually matter?
Well, the text starts off by making a point that really stood out to me. It says morality isn't just this abstract concept.
Right.
It's something we're actually living out, like, every single day.
That's true.
It shapes how we relate to others, the choices we make, even how we see ourselves.
Yeah, it's like we're constantly making these judgments about what's right and what's wrong. I mean, and the text even jumps right into defining, like, ethical and moral. I feel like we use those words kind of interchangeably.
Yeah, you do hear them used that way a lot, but the text does point out there's a subtle difference.
Okay.
So ethics seems to be more about individual character, like your personal integrity, your own set of values.
Right.
Morality, though, that's more about how those values actually play out and how you treat other people. It's about your choices and how they affect others.
So ethics is like who you are at your core,
mm-hmm.
and morality is how you interact with the world around you.
Exactly. And I think understanding that little difference, it
okay.
can really help you see why people might look at a moral dilemma, like, from totally different angles.
Yeah, that makes sense. But what about when someone just seems to be completely lacking a moral compass?
Right.
I think the text calls that amoral. And they actually give a real-life example, which is kind of disturbing. This guy, Gregory Powell. He committed this awful crime and showed absolutely no remorse, none.
Yeah, and that case really reminds you, I think, that while most people do have some sense of right and wrong, you know,
yeah.
there are people out there who seem to operate outside of those boundaries entirely.
Totally. And then there's non-moral, right?
Yeah.
That's the stuff that's just not even in the realm of morality, right?
Right.
Like my phone, I guess. It's not good or bad. It's just a phone.
Right.
But even something like a phone could, I guess, be part of a moral dilemma. Depending on how it's used.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, think about using it to spread, like, misinformation or to bully someone online.
Right, right.
Suddenly, you know, a non-moral thing is in the middle of this whole moral situation.
Okay, yeah, good point.
Yeah.
So how do we even start to understand something as big and messy as morality?
Mm-hmm.
Are there different ways to study it, would you say?
Well, the text talks about two main approaches, like the scientific approach
okay.
and the philosophical approach. So the scientific approach, it kind of looks at human behavior,
uh-huh.
like how people actually act in moral situations, sort of like a scientist observing and gathering data.
So less about just theorizing, more about what people actually do.
Exactly. Okay.
Oh, interesting.
And then you've got the philosophical approach, which is more about, like, the shoulds and oughts of how we behave.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are, like, two branches to that. One's about, you know, how we should act. And then the other, it dives into the actual language, the logic that we use when we talk about ethics.
It sounds like that encourages people to really think critically about their own beliefs.
Yeah, it does.
About morality, like where they come from.
Yeah. And I think this whole deep dive, it's really about, like, helping you build those critical thinking skills, especially when it comes to morality.
Yeah, I'm here for it.
Yeah.
But I am curious, before we move on too far, what does the text say about what actually makes something good or bad?
Oh, that's a big one.
Right.
Well, it talks about this idea of hedonism. That's the idea that what's good is tied to pleasure.
Okay.
And what's bad is tied to pain.
Which, I mean, makes sense, right? On, like, a really basic level.
Yeah.
We want to do things that feel good.
Right.
And avoid things that hurt.
Yeah, you gravitate towards, you know, what feels good.
But is it really that simple?
Hmm. That's where it gets interesting. It's not just about chasing, like, instant gratification.
Oh, okay.
The text really stresses that true happiness often means, you know, you have to put up with some pain in the short term to get something better in the long run. Think about going to the dentist.
Oh, yeah. Nobody likes getting a cavity filled.
Right. But we put up with that pain because we want healthy teeth.
Right. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
For the long-term benefit. But then it makes me think, what about those situations where, like, one person's pleasure ends up causing someone else pain?
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you have, like, a malicious pleasure? Is there even such a thing?
Right. That's a good question.
There's always more to think about, you know?
Yeah. And it's important to remember, you know, morality, it's not the same as our sense of beauty, like aesthetics or even manners, you know,
yeah.
like social etiquette.
So I can appreciate, like, a beautiful painting, even if I don't agree with the message it's trying to convey.
Right.
And I can be polite to someone without thinking they're a good person.
Exactly. And the text actually uses a great example here. They talk about the civil rights sit-ins. Back then, those were seen as totally breaking social norms, but they were driven by a deep moral conviction, you know?
Sometimes challenging what everyone thinks is normal can be the right thing to do, even if it goes against what people expect. So where does morality actually apply in our everyday lives? Mm-hmm. Like, does it show up everywhere?
Well, the text breaks it down into a few areas. It talks about religious morality, nature-related morality, individual morality, and social morality.
Sounds like there's a moral dimension to almost everything we do.
There really is. Yeah. But the text emphasizes social morality, you know, how we interact with each other as being maybe the most important, the most prominent.
Even if you were, like, stranded on a desert island all alone.
That's a good question. They actually use that example. Robinson Crusoe, right?
Right, right.
They argue that even though he's alone, he's still making individual moral choices, you know, how he treats himself and the island.
Yeah.
But his capacity for, like, true moral action, it would be limited compared to being part of community.
Okay. So morality really thrives in a social context.
Yeah.
Interesting. So where does our sense of right and wrong actually come from? Is it, like, a higher power?
Yeah.
Nature? Yeah. Or are we just making it all up as we go along?
Right. It's like the ultimate question.
Right.
And the text looks at all those possibilities. Like, is morality objective, meaning it comes from outside of us?
Mm.
Or is it subjective, like we create it?
I need answers.
Well, what the text suggests is that morality is probably this complex interplay between, you know, people and things playing out in specific situations.
Okay.
It's not a simple answer, but it acknowledges just how messy it really is, how we form our values.
Yeah, I guess it's never just one thing. It's a lot of different factors all coming together.
Right. And this brings us to, like, another important distinction.
Okay.
Customary morality versus reflective morality.
Ooh, okay. Break those down for me.
So customary morality, that's like what we inherit.
Uh-huh.
It comes from our families, our cultures, the traditions we grow up with, the values that we're raised with, often without even questioning them.
Like our moral starting point.
Exactly. The foundation. But then as we grow, we encounter new ideas, different experiences, and that's where reflective morality kicks in.
So reflective morality is when we start to, like, step back and actually look at those inherited values with a critical eye.
Yeah.
Like, do they still make sense to me?
Exactly. It's moving from just accepting things to making a conscious choice. Like, think about the Ten Commandments, right? Most people know what they are.
Here.
But how many have actually sat down and thought, what do they actually mean? And how do I apply those principles to my life today?
I've never thought about it that way, actually.
And this deep dive, that's exactly what we're trying to do. Encourage that kind of reflection, you know, help you become more aware of what you believe and why.
This is good stuff. I do have to ask, though, what about how morality relates to law and religion?
Ah, yes.
I mean, are they the same thing?
Well, you know, that's a pretty common misconception. And the text makes it clear they are not the same thing.
So we could have laws that are immoral and moral actions that are against the law.
Exactly. Morality can influence law, you know, but it's not always bound by it. Like, for instance, you know, laws against slavery, those were enacted because people's moral views on slavery shifted.
So morality can be like a driving force for legal change.
Yeah. The text asks a really good question here, actually.
Oh.
Can you think of any laws that don't have any moral significance? It's a good challenge.
Mm.
Makes you really think.
I'll have to ponder that one.
Mm-hmm.
What about religion, though? Do you have to be religious to be a moral person?
That is the big question, isn't it? It's been debated forever.
Yeah. What does the text say?
It argues that you don't actually have to be religious to be moral.
Oh.
There are ethical systems that are completely non-religious, and plenty of people who don't follow any religion at all live very moral lives.
So recognizing that morality can exist separate from religious belief.
Exactly. And the text even calls for something it calls humanitarian ethics, like a set of values that goes beyond religion and brings us together based on our shared humanity.
That sounds pretty powerful.
It is.
And hopeful, you know, finding common ground, even with different beliefs. This is all so fascinating. But are there any frameworks for understanding how we develop our moral reasoning? Like, as we grow older.
There are. The text introduces this theory by Kohlberg.
Okay.
About how moral development happens.
Okay, so what's the main takeaway from that theory?
Well, Kohlberg's idea was that moral thinking goes through these stages, you know, starting with just, like, focusing on rewards and punishments.
Right.
To ultimately reaching a deeper understanding of, like, these universal ethical principles.
Like a roadmap for how our moral compass evolves.
Exactly. And this deep dive, what we're doing here, it's actually helping you move along that roadmap too.
Oh, nice.
Encouraging you to think more deeply, more, you know, with more nuance about morality.
I can definitely feel that happening. But if morality isn't like a set of rules handed down from above or laws that we have to follow.
Right.
Why bother being moral in the first place? Like, what's the point?
That's a huge question. And the text explores several different answers.
Okay, so what are some of those answers?
Well, it looks at arguments about, like, enlightened self-interest.
Okay.
The importance of tradition and law, and even the idea that as humans, we just naturally need certain things, like cooperation and moral behavior.
So practical reasons as well as philosophical reasons.
Yeah, exactly. And while the text doesn't claim to have like the absolute definitive answer to that question of why be moral, it does make a pretty strong case for it.
Thanks.
It really is essential for both, you know, individual happiness and a good society.
Yeah, I'm starting to see that.
Good.
We've definitely covered a lot of ground already.
We have.
And I'm excited to keep going to get into like specific ethical viewpoints, real world dilemmas. But I think this is a good spot to take a little break for now.
I agree. We've laid a good foundation.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to seeing where it takes us.
All right. So we're back. We've been talking about like the foundations of morality, right? What it is, where it comes from, why it even matters.
Right.
But now I think things are going to get even more interesting because we're going to actually look at some specific ethical viewpoints.
Yeah. It's like we're moving from the what to the how.
Okay.
How do we actually make ethical decisions? The text focuses on three main ethical frameworks: ethical egoism, utilitarianism, and then there's non-consequentialism.
Okay, so three very different ways of looking at how to navigate the moral landscape.
Exactly.
So let's start with ethical egoism. I mean, the name itself sounds a little self-centered, doesn't it?
It does, kind of, yeah. But ethical egoism isn't about being selfish, like in the way we usually think of it.
Okay.
It argues that we should act in our own self-interest.
Okay.
But it's more about long-term well-being, not just immediate pleasure.
So it's not about grabbing that extra cookie, even if I really want it.
Right.
If I'm going to regret it later.
Exactly. It's about like making the choices that are ultimately going to benefit you down the road.
Okay.
Ethical egoists believe that when everyone prioritizes their own rational self-interest,
yeah,
it actually ends up creating a more stable and harmonious society.
Mm. Okay, but what happens when my self-interest clashes with someone else's self-interest?
Right.
Like, wouldn't that just lead to constant conflict?
Yeah, and that's actually one of the big criticisms of ethical egoism.
Yeah.
It can be really hard to reconcile those competing interests.
Yeah.
It doesn't always give you a clear way to decide what's fair when, you know, those clashes happen.
So maybe it works well in theory, but in real life, it gets a little trickier.
Yeah, could be. What about utilitarianism?
Okay, yeah, let's talk about that. That one sounds a little bit more focused on, like, the greater good.
It is, yeah. Utilitarianism is all about trying to maximize happiness and minimize suffering for the most people possible.
It's like the greatest good for the greatest number. That's the classic phrase.
Right, right. So instead of focusing on what's best for me, I should be thinking about what creates the most happiness for everyone involved.
Yeah, exactly. A utilitarian would say you should always choose the action that's going to lead to the best overall outcome, you know?
Right.
Taking into account everybody who might be affected.
Which, I mean, yeah, sounds pretty reasonable.
Right.
But how do you actually measure happiness and suffering? That seems so subjective.
Right. And that's definitely a challenge for utilitarianism.
Okay.
It's hard to, like, quantify those things,
right,
you know,
right,
and to predict how your actions are going to play out in the long run.
Right. Because what makes one person happy might make someone else miserable.
Exactly.
And then, like, is all happiness created equal?
Hmm.
Is the joy of listening to my favorite song the same as, like, the joy of achieving a lifelong dream?
Right.
And what about when an action causes a little bit of harm to a few people, but then it creates a lot of happiness for a larger group?
Yeah. Like, does the end justify the means in that kind of situation?
Those are exactly the dilemmas that utilitarianism struggles with, you know. It can sometimes lead to outcomes that just feel unfair to certain individuals, even if it benefits the majority overall.
So once again, there are strengths and weaknesses. No easy answers. What about this third category, non-consequentialism? How's that different?
Okay, so non-consequentialism is all about whether an action is right or wrong in itself,
Okay.
regardless of the outcome. It's about following moral rules and principles, even if they don't always lead to the best result.
So not about calculating happiness or weighing pros and cons, it's about sticking to your moral code.
You got it. And the big name in non-consequentialism is Immanuel Kant. He came up with this thing called the categorical imperative.
The what?
The categorical imperative.
Okay, I've never heard of that. What is that?
It's basically a test you can use to decide if something is morally okay.
Okay.
Kant said you should only act according to rules that you could universalize, meaning rules that you'd be okay with everyone following all the time.
So, like, if I'm thinking about breaking a promise,
Right.
I should ask myself, would I be okay with everyone breaking promises whenever it's convenient? And if
Exactly.
the answer is no, then it's wrong to break the promise.
Right, no matter what the reason is.
Okay.
Kant believed that this kind of reasoning, it would lead to actions that respect everyone equally.
So it's definitely a principled way to look at these tough decisions.
Yeah.
But what if following a moral rule leads to, like, a really bad outcome? Shouldn't there be some flexibility?
Yeah, and that is a valid critique of non-consequentialism.
Okay.
It can be too rigid, too inflexible, and it might accidentally cause harm in some cases.
Yeah.
Some critics argue that, you have to think about the context of
Right.
your actions, not just blindly follow a rule.
It seems like, once again, there's no one perfect solution.
Right.
It's more about finding the best approach for each situation, taking everything into account.
And that's where the text introduces this really helpful tool, a five-step model for ethical decision-making.
Ooh, like a step-by-step guide to help navigate these tricky situations.
Exactly.
All right, I'm all ears. What's step one?
Step one is just recognizing that there's even an ethical issue to begin with. It seems obvious, but sometimes we just need to stop and think, is there a moral dimension to this situation?
Right, being aware of how our choices might impact ourselves and others. Okay, what's next?
The next step is gathering all the information.
Okay.
So we do our research, make sure we understand the facts, all the different viewpoints involved, and the possible consequences of each action.
So due diligence,
Yeah.
getting the whole picture.
Yeah,
Knowledge
exactly.
is power, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you're making tough choices. Okay, so what's step three?
Step three is where we actually start weighing our options.
Okay.
We figure out what the different courses of action are,
Huh?
and we think about them from different angles.
So it's like having a debate with yourself, thinking about the pros and cons of each choice from all those ethical perspectives.
Exactly. You can even use those ethical frameworks we talked about,
Right.
ethical egoism, utilitarianism, non-consequentialism.
Time to put on the thinking cap.
Yeah.
But how do we actually make the decision after considering all the options?
Right. So step four is about choosing a course of action
Okay.
and then testing it against different ethical standards.
Testing it. What do you mean?
Well, we can ask ourselves things like, can I justify this decision to other people?
Okay.
Would I be comfortable with this decision becoming public?
Right.
Those kinds of things, they help us check in with our own sense of integrity, make sure we're making a choice we can actually stand behind.
It's like holding yourself accountable, right? Okay, so what about the final step?
Right. So finally, we get to step five, which is actually acting on your decision
Okay.
and then reflecting on how it turns out.
So we actually take the leap and do it, but it doesn't end there, does it?
No. Ethical decision making, it's an ongoing thing, right? You have to reflect on the results, learn from what happened, and be willing to maybe change your approach in the future. It's a continuous cycle, choosing, acting, reflecting, and growing.
Yeah, it's a journey. It's
Yeah.
about becoming more morally mature and really trying to live a life that aligns with your values.
I couldn't have said it better myself. So yeah, we've covered a lot in this part of our deep dive.
We have.
We've explored different ways of looking at ethics and even a practical model for making those tough decisions. But, the real test comes when we try to apply these things to real life problems.
That's what I'm most curious about. Like, how does all this play out in actual situations?
Well, get ready. It's going to be fascinating. We're going to look at areas like business ethics, bioethics, even the ethics of war and peace.
Wow, we're really getting into it now. Sounds like a wild ride.
It is. It's time to take everything we've learned and
Yeah.
see how it helps us understand the moral landscape of the world around us.
So we've covered a lot in this deep dive, what morality is, where it comes from, different ways to make ethical decisions. But now I want to see how all this actually plays out in the real world.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the text points out, moral questions, they pop up everywhere. you know, from our own personal relationships to like huge global issues.
So let's talk specifics. What are some of the areas where this stuff really comes into play?
Well, the text highlights a few. Business ethics.
Okay.
Bioethics.
Uh-huh.
Environmental ethics. And then there's the ethics of war and peace.
Wow. Okay, that's a lot to unpack.
Right.
Let's start with business ethics. I mean, what kind of moral challenges do businesses even face?
Well, the text talks about things like honesty in advertising, treating employees fairly, and corporate social responsibility. It's about businesses acting ethically, not just trying to make as much money as possible no matter what.
So, like, a company shouldn't lie about its products or exploit its workers or pollute the environment just to make a quick profit.
Exactly. Ethical businesses, they think about the impact of their actions on, like, everyone.
Okay.
Customers, employees, the community, even the planet.
It's like that golden rule, right? Do unto others.
Yeah.
I mean, that applies to businesses too, right?
It absolutely does. They have to realize they're part of something bigger, you know? Yeah. Their actions have consequences that go way beyond just, you know, their bottom line.
Which actually brings us to bioethics, which is, I mean, that's where moral questions get really personal, right?
You could say that bioethics is about some of the biggest issues we face, you know, like life and death and everything in between.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about abortion, euthanasia, genetic engineering, access to healthcare. It's intense.
It is. It's all about finding that balance, you know, between ethical principles and scientific progress.
Right.
And all those deeply personal beliefs that people hold. Bioethics really makes us ask, what does it even mean to live a good life, you know? And what do we owe future generations?
Those are questions that everyone asks at some point, right? And speaking of future generations, I mean, that takes us to environmental ethics.
Right. And that's an area that's just becoming more and more pressing, you know?
Yeah.
As we deal with climate change, pollution, all that. Environmental ethics is about our moral duty to the natural world.
So it's more than just recycling or saving water, right?
Yeah, it is. It's about recognizing that the environment has value in and of itself.
Okay.
Not just as something we can use up and exploit, you know? We got to shift our thinking from dominating nature to being responsible for it.
From taking to giving, right?
Yeah.
Protecting the planet, not just for us, but for all the creatures that live here, you know? And for the generations to come after us. I mean, that's a huge responsibility.
It is. It forces us to think long term about the impact of our actions, not just what's good for us right now.
So, last but not least, there's the ethics of war and peace. I mean, the stakes really don't get any higher than that, do they?
No, they don't. And this is where, you know, morality and some of the toughest decisions that societies have to make really collide.
Yeah.
The text digs into, like, reasons for going to war, principles of just war theory, even how to build lasting peace.
So asking questions like, when is it morally okay to go to war?
Right.
Are there rules for how wars should be fought?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we create a world where, you know, violence isn't the answer to every conflict?
Yeah. Those are big questions for sure. And there aren't any easy answers.
It's heavy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This whole deep dive, it's been, I mean, it's made me think about so much.
Me too.
But I'm wondering, where do we go from here? Like, what's the takeaway for everyone listening?
I think the text actually leaves us with a pretty powerful challenge. It goes back to ancient Greece, this philosopher, Plato. He told this story about Gyges, who finds a ring that makes him invisible.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he uses it to do all kinds of bad things, right?
Right, because he figures, hey, no one can see me. And the question the text poses is, would you still be a moral person if you knew you could get away with anything?
Hmm.
Would you still choose to do the right thing, even if there were no consequences for doing the wrong thing?
That's a question that really gets to the heart of it all, doesn't it?
It does. It makes you think about why you make the choices you make.
Yeah. Like, are you doing the right thing out of fear of getting caught? Or are you doing it because it's just, like, who you are?
Exactly. Real morality isn't about blindly following rules.
Right.
It's about developing that inner sense of what's right.
Yeah. Like your own internal compass.
Yeah, that guides you, even when nobody's looking. And that, I think, brings us back to where we started. Morality, it's not just about external stuff. It's about who you are deep down.
Right. It's about the choices you make, even when it's hard, even when you might be tempted to do something else.
That's it. That's the journey, you know? It's a journey we're all on together.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into morality.
Mm.
We hope it's given you some things to think about.
Yeah, I hope so. Keep asking those big questions. And remember, you know, trying to live a moral life, it's a journey worth taking.
Absolutely. And that's it for this deep dive, folks. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.